This is the Mixed Media Audio Zine for the first quarter of 2013. I'm DJ Frederick, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading from independent zines and journals and spinning some music as well. I'd like to start off today reading from Angry Violist number 6. Emma, who is the editor and publisher of Angry Violist, says, "Angry Violist is a zine about music, making music, finding your place as a musician, alternative string playing, experimental music, and other things. It's for disgruntled classical musicians, music lovers, and anyone who wants a more experimental future." I'm going to be reading from a piece by Emma called "Getting Over Good Enough." What if good enough crosses a line and becomes inherently linked with your music making in a damaging way? What then? There's a problem. This might be scary, but here are some methods to overcome the tyranny of good enough. Record yourself playing. Do your best. Listen back to the recording a few days later and respond to it critically as you might to a friend's playing. You wouldn't say to a friend, "Nah, your playing sounds shit, mate." So why talk to yourself that way? The main thing here is to put some distance between yourself and the recording. Pretend it isn't you. Get some perspective. Be honest and reappraise yourself. Ask yourself what good enough consists of. What does it look like to you? Give your concept of good enough a value. Is it being able to play a G melodic minor scale from memory? Is it learning the Lemon Song on bass guitar? God help you. If you can assign a real target to what good enough is to you, then go and pursue it. But don't forget that just because you can't play that one thing, you are not a good enough musician until you can. Is your standard of good enough reasonable? If you can't quantify it or put your finger on that one specific thing that makes you good enough when you are able to do it, maybe your standards are wrong. This is tough love, dearest reader. Maybe they were entirely arbitrary. If so, where are these standards from? Who has created them? Beware the exam board / music school syllabus. They aren't your standards. They belong to them, to the examiners, not to you. You are just expected to fit in. Those criteria and standards for good enough might not be right for you. You wouldn't ask a runner to take part in a horse race, though this would be undoubtedly loads of fun. Likewise, don't beat yourself over the head with a classical viola syllabus if all you want to do is play rock and roll. Challenge your fears head on. Some guy once wrote in some book that I've never read to feel the fear and do it anyway. What I'm taking from this ill-informed nugget of recollection of mine is the idea that you should try to get out of your comfort zone if you want to challenge your fears, anxieties, and the ways of thinking that are damaging to you. Get out of your comfort zone because maybe, just maybe, it sucks a little bit and needs to change. Talk to other musicians that you admire and or trust, not for critical perspective on how you play, but for their take on the idea of good enough. Do they think that they are good enough? You might be surprised. It seems to be music's dirty little secret that everyone worries about this. Play with other musicians. This is a tricky one to do, but it is massively rewarding. Playing with others can help get a perspective on your own playing, not via direct comparison in some kind of musician's league table, but by showing yourself what you are capable of. Keep an open mind. Prepare to feel a bit scared. Where is your critical inner voice coming from? There may be ghosts in your music, from before. I remember trying to quit altogether, hating music for a good few years because some snotty-nosed kid in my class took the piss out of my face while I was playing. I was one of those kids who got so into concentrating on playing that I screwed and scrunched up my face every which way whilst I was playing violin. You know, while I was emoting in that. Fine for singers in a boy band, not so fine, apparently, for rookie violinists. Anyway, I avoided playing in front of anyone for years afterwards. It was her voice that I heard in my head telling me I'd look stupid if I got up on stage. Addendum. That girl still lives in the same town, with a million kids snapping at her ankles, whilst I am a mighty zine writer, so suck on that. Identifying where your critical voice really comes from is a first step to overcoming it. The main thing is, I suppose, keep questioning. Stay critical and keep pushing yourself to the edges of what feels comfortable. I am not a psychologist, counselor, or therapist. Take my advice under caution. Some of this is from a branch of therapy called cognitive behavioral therapy, and some from cognitive analytical therapy, in case you want to find out more reliable source of advice for getting over being good enough. Good luck. You can do it. And that was from Emma and Angry Violist number 6. For more information, check out angryviolist.wordpress.com.
When the sun is out, children sing. Sky is gray, my soul is dark as a wave. Calmly we await the cyclone's vernal retreat. Nestled access fame.
That was Appendix Out with Cyclone's Vernal Retreat. You're listening to the Mixed Media Audio Zine with DJ Frederick. I'd like to read a piece from Reflections in Lead by Ron Hilton, Chinook, Washington, who publishes a small journal that is letterpressed. 100 years ago, January 7th, it was a dark and very stormy night. When I first moved into my residence, some 12 or so years ago, I quickly became aware of an intruder in my bedroom, a light. The source of this beam is Cape Disappointment Lighthouse, guardian of the mouth of the Columbia River, where it and the Pacific Ocean have done battle for centuries on end. Here the tides, the geography, and yes, the weather have hampered mankind's efforts to allow for shipping until the advent of navigation and propulsion systems more advanced than sail and sea to the pants by guess and by golly guidance and mapping. This is the graveyard of the Pacific, so named due to the large number of shipwrecks in past years. There have been some 500 such incidents dating back to the early 1800s, the heydays of sail, and events as late as the 1960s and 70s, when technology got the upper hand. Here's one such incident. Ship sinks with 33. Oil tank ship Rosecrans is wrecked in gale on the Pacific coast. That was published in January 8, 1913, in the New York Times. Astoria, Oregon, January 7, 1913. The oil tank steamship Rosecrans, Captain L.F. Johnson, from Monterey, California, bound for Portland, Oregon, ran aground early today on Peacock Spit while striving to reach the Columbia River during a 50-mile gale and was lost with 33 members of her crew of 37. One survivor of the wreck, it was reported tonight, had reached safety at Tioga, Washington, 6 miles from the scene of the wreck. When the tugboats reached the neighborhood of the vessel, she was found to be hard aground, and the high seas driving winds made near approach impossible. The Rosecrans soon shifted and began to break up, and before the tugs and lifesavers could get near enough to put line aboard, she slipped off the rocks and sank, until only her masts and the funnel appeared above the water, with 3 men of the crew clinging to the rigging. End of story? Hardly. So one might ask, what the heck got you interested in such an incident? And the correct answer is James A. Gibbs, the author. Now, unless you are a maritime history buff like me, the name may escape you, but Mr. Gibbs, appropriately enough, a U.S. Coast Guard veteran, spent his life writing about West Coast shipwrecks, lighthouses, and related topics. In fact, he lived in a lighthouse on the Oregon coast until his passing away several years ago. The Rosecrans was en route to Portland from San Francisco with 20,000 barrels of crude oil valued at $200,000 when she sailed into a 60-mile gale off the mouth of the Columbia River. Captain Johnson lost his bearings and left his ship overrun with a channel entrance, coming head-on with a tip of Peacock Spit. A distress message was picked up at Cape Disappointment at 5:15 a.m. Steamer Rosecrans on bar. Send assistance. Ship breaking up fast. Can stay at my station no longer. Now this might be the end of the story, but young wireless operator in service but few months goes down with ill-fated Rosecrans with call for help unfinished. Astoria, Oregon, January 18th, 1913. Lawrence A. Prudhomme was the wireless operator on the Associated Oil Company's tank steamer Rosecrans, which was wrecked off Peacock Spit the morning of January 7th, and it was he who sent the hurried SOS call, which brought a quick response from the life-saving crews and tugboats in an effort to give assistance to the distressed craft. This call, which was never finished on account of the destruction of the operating room by the heavy seas, read as follows. Rosecrans wrecked at bar. Send assistance. Can stay no longer. The crash came so suddenly that the last word was evidently help, and it was never concluded. Lawrence Prudhomme, who stayed at his post so long as the wireless would work, trying to summon assistance, and who lost his life in the disaster, was 21 years of age and a son of A. Prudhomme of Venice, California. He had been on the vessel only a few months. His body has not been recovered. Lawrence was not alone among the early wireless operators in striving to stay at his station in the face of disaster. 25 other wireless operators who lost their lives at sea were commemorated in the Memorial Fountain to Wireless Operators in New York City in 1915. That was a reading from Reflections in Lead by Ron Hilton from Chinook, Washington.
Dream.
That was a band called Brasby from my home state of New Hampshire, Legend of Mount Monadnock. And before that, Trembling Blue Stars with Rainbow. This is DJ Frederick, and you're listening to the Mixed Media Audio Zine. Before I end this edition, I would like to read a poem by Clarence Wolfshole. This is from a small booklet that he published and mailed to members of the American Amateur Press Association. This is his poem called Our First Christmas. Remember that first tree? Not a tree, we couldn't afford one, nor gifts, it seems, but a tumbleweed found in a lot across Grand Avenue. You sprayed it, white as if snow had settled on it, then made ornaments of remnants of yarn from Mrs. Finch, whose gift to us was a respite from rent. You made small hoyos de Dios of blue and gold, the gold, the center spot and tassels at the four directions. The blue was the same as your eyes, and the gold reminded me of the flecks of amber that made me smile each time I looked there. Your eyes are closed now. I cannot look there again. The Oyos I see clearly against the snows of winter. That was Our First Christmas by Clarence Wolfshole. Here's Appendix Out with A Path to Our Beds.
It's
stars are colors to hover above with the stretch of the golden path to our shall